Hello, everyone.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. This is Sally O'Cordy, and welcome to Public Advocate. I am running for Public Advocate of New York City to ban vaccines in 2013. Everything you will need to know is directly under the screen, so please visit my blog and understand the danger you put your children in when you accept vaccination for them. Okay, my guest is going to be Joe Jones, and he is going to share his heart song with you. Joe Jones is a friend of mine from Facebook, but we have become far more than that. We are buds. He's my bud, I'm his bud, and we are certainly there for one another. He is an extremely talented person with a large heart, and his talents are in the realm of artistic painting, and he's known for his airplane paintings from World War II in particular, but he has done them from all ages, you know, from all the ages, from the beginning of planedom onward, and he's known and respected in that realm. I adore his artwork and have ordered two of his prints for a Bob Hope exhibition for the Museum of Comedy. We are doing a salute to Bob Hope in World War II, and I have artifacts from him. And I have a letter, actually, written directly to me from him, Silly Sally at the Museum of Comedy. So Joe's artwork really did embellish the tenor of his work during World War II in the fields with the troops, entertaining. And I contend that Bob Hope saved more lives, possibly, than anyone else, because everybody put down their weapons to come and listen to him. I even understand the enemy put down their weapons and came to listen to him. So if all those times he visited and all those hours he performed, all those shots weren't fired, if you think of it that way. And, my friend Joe Jones is on. I also would like to say he is a very remarkable composer, not just an artist, but a composer. Hi, Joe Jones.
Hey, Sally, how you doing there, baby?
Oh, I'm just fine, thank you. I've asked you to come on and share your heart song. You and I work on very serious issues together. We spend hours trying to wake people up and trying to stop right the wrongs. And it's kind of time that we reach out to people, not on an intellectual level, but on a heart level. So I have asked you to come on and share the story of somebody or people whom have touched your heart. And in so doing, we hope to connect to others. So welcome, Joe Jones. And who will you be talking about today?
Well, Sally, I tell you, my heart song, and I thought about this, and even above, you know, guys like George Harrison and John Lennon even, and some of the other heroes in my life, today I certainly would pay tribute and devote this heart song to my parents, Eileen and Arthur Jones, two of the most remarkable beings that I ever could have been blessed with in my life. So, you know, it I would care to share that with you and your audience, and hopefully through this, you know, people will be able to relate and you know, possibly even see these qualities within their own parents or other folks, and be able to identify people out there in our lives that really are not just good people, but they really put it out there. They every day they wake up and make an earnest effort to change their world in a positive manner, and that certainly was not probably the goal of my parents in what they did. However, through their wisdom and guidance and just bottomless, this incredible expanse of love that they had. Again, the effects that they have had on countless individuals is just profound. And I'll share this story with your audience. But again, that's kind of where I'd like to start, Sally. So yeah.
Well, I would like you to start with the most remarkable thing about your parents so that people realize who you're talking about. Because, go ahead, tell the audience how many children your parents adopted.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing. And what I thought I'd do is, just kind of start by... again, kind of describing really a virtual almost, a sainthood, and I certainly don't mean that lightly, but you can, these, enlightened beings and their story and how they affected my life and so many others, and tie this into kind of even a bigger picture, coming full circle to where folks like you and I are, and the the influence in our lives that have helped guide us to understand in our hearts almost inherently what is real, what is right, and what we need to do, what our path is. And again, both my father and mother really were instrumental, and it's kind of interesting. Let me read a real quick quote by Maya Angelou, who wrote, "I think a hero is a person really intent on making a better place for us all." And I think that there, it's just such simple wisdom of what a hero is. And I have worked with veterans for the last 20 years, expanding five wars and countless conflicts, and I certainly do know the qualities in which makes a hero. One, of course, is someone that chooses to put themselves in harm's way, knowing full well what the dangers are, but doing it because they knew in their heart it was right, and certainly in most cases it would be to the benefit of others. My parents were that and a lot more. When we defined the term hero, very quickly, just kind of a snapshot of these two individuals. My father was a simple man from a small Kansas town, very simple upbringing, worked his way through. He served in the Korean War. He did photo recon in the nose of B-25s in the early part of the war, and went on to be shipped back stateside, and he, of course, retired from the Air Force and started working for a contractor of NASA during the 60s, which was Martin Marietta. So, of course, when I was growing up, we grew up on the inside of the space race. We, that was a big part of our family upbringing, was understanding. I sat with my father, for years, Saturday evening, when The World at War would come on, that wonderful BBC series. And, I would sit with my father quietly watching that series, and really it really gave me a broader view as just a small boy of our world and the complexity and the you know, the sadness and, you know, again, the ravages of our own species. But, you know, through that was, of course, the wonder of the whole, you know, jetpack, you know, jet age and that. I was just a little too young to have experienced really the fear of the Cold War era, which, again, if I remember right, was it lasted 24/7 all the way up through 1993, I believe, is when it was officially, you know, the end of the Cold War was called. Those were some scary years, and anyone in the military knew that. Again, you know, I was born just a month or so too after John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and grew up again through the 60s, again marveling, you know, the whole jet age and the rocket age. You know, we grew up in a household where American pioneers and forefathers, these extraordinary astronauts, and I certainly will name off three that gave all for the betterment of humanity and such, which was, of course, the crew of Apollo 1, Gus Grissom, Alan, let me think, it was White and, oh, doggone, I just had it on the tip of my tongue. Of course, the crew of Apollo 1 who perished in the capsule of Apollo 1 as they were going through their process of testing and stuff. It was just horrible, and we felt that in our family. By the time we went through and by the time we got to Apollo 11, and, of course, as a young kid, I was only 6 years old when Neil Armstrong. In fact, it's now been what, 34, excuse me, not 34, I'm just trying to remember how many years now. It was, in fact, July 20th, 1969, when Neil Armstrong took that first step for mankind. You know, again, my father, he knew Neil Armstrong. He had met all of these guys, all of the Redstone astronauts, all of the Gemini fellas, and again, many, many of the Apollo astronauts. My father ultimately met decades before I did, ultimately, but he knew these fellows.
Well,
and
how did he know them?
From again working at Martin Marietta. You know, again, this was a massive, you know, how can I say, manufacturing and test bed and development plant for NASA, where they built all kinds of stuff, including, you know, much of Skylab was built by Martin Marietta. The whole, again, the, oh, there was many, many missions and vehicles and all types of things that were built and tested and implemented from Martin Marietta at that time. So again, through those days, you know, my father got to meet these guys, and it was just interesting talking with them about, you know, that. So again, that's what, you know, on one hand, you know, that's what my father brought to our family. He was one of the hardest working fellows. He worked two jobs as long as I could remember. And he, at the same time, took time with all of us, which was just remarkable. And as I tell this story, I think that's one of the, as I look back, one of the most remarkable things that my parents actually managed to do was to share with all of us kids. And there was a bunch, and I'll tell you here in a second, you know. So again, you know, my father, you know, again, he kind of came from, you know, a bit of an aviation background and aerospace, and you know, we ended up in Denver at, he was stationed at Lowry Air Force Base, he studied there and such, and again, kind of went on and retired from Martin Marietta. Really, really interesting fella, very quiet guy, but, you know, again, when you got him started, you know, he just what a charming man, and the stories and witticisms, and just the little, you know, sayings, you know, it's just so funny, you know. It just, still to this day, just cracks me up, you know. When something ever happens, you know, it's like, oh, good gravy, not this. And, you know, he would just say, you know, well, you're going to have some of that, you know. And I still to this day, I use that, you're going to have some of that. But, you know, they kind of paint a bit of a picture of my father. You know, he was also very creative. He was also artistic. And in fact, I now am a Emmy Award. I won my first Emmy Award as an aviation illustrator, a historic aviation artist, about 3 years ago. And I was just overjoyed the day I got to tell my father about that. My father, really going back to coloring books, you know, really took time with me to teach me how not just to color inside the lines, but really, you know, to give it some depth and a background. And, you know, one of the things, again, he taught me was how to shade, you know, where you'd have a dimensional object, an apple, orange, you know, an astronaut, anything. And he taught me how to actually shade and understand lighting, you know, light and shadow, and even things like perspective and just the building blocks of illustration. You know, he taught me that very early on, and as long as I could remember, I've always been an artist since I was a tiny kid. And, you know, my Emmy, you know, and my other awards, now being the most awarded artist in airshow history, I've won more international awards and first place awards by a group called the International Council of Air Shows, ICAF, and our work doing air show artwork, posters and that kind of event stuff for air shows, we're judged against 13 other countries. And in fact, 1 year in 2004, it was the 60th anniversary of D-Day. I did a piece that took me months, in fact, nearly 9 months to research and complete for Nellis Air Force Base. And that piece went on in air show history to break all records. It won 5 first place awards, which had never been done in air show history ever. It was just remarkable.
Which of your artwork, I know them all, which one are you referring to?
It was a piece depicting the D-Day invasion from the air. It had slews of B-17s and C-47s towing these what were called Hadrian gliders. It was Operation Overlord. It was the launch of D-Day, and that's what it depicts.
Can people see this on airmail-greetings.com?
I do believe so, and in fact, okay. I will say it's coming from very humble beginnings, you know, with coloring books with my father, to where ultimately, and this just kills me, you know. And in fact, the day I went out to Washington, D.C., and this happened, you know, I just cried. I ultimately would become the very first digital aviation illustrator to ever have their digital artwork displayed in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in their history. I was the very first. I certainly, going all the way back, I just attest to, you know, those early days, sitting there, you know, on the weekends, getting some tips from dad, and then spending, you know, days, you know, and then I'd show them, you know, and show mom and dad, you know, what I did. And I spent, you know, my early years, you know, again, just coloring and then getting into painting. And, you know, it was just a wonderful, you know, nurturing kind of certainly environment and that kind of relationship. Dad didn't have a lot of time, but doggone it, he made it a point to love and hug and spend time with all of us. Just to mention, my father and my mother, ultimately would become foster parents. And remarkable. I mean, just remarkable. The term foster parents, you know, that conjures, particularly these days, you know, really kind of these dim basements and, you know, just these cramped, you know, spaces where, you know, again, these foster parents are forced now to, by law, give, you know, all measures of, you know, drugs and it's sickening what, my younger brother is a foster parent, and we've talked much about how it is these days and how the apparatus is to drug these kids that are in foster homes, particularly these days. Most, and I say most, I'm talking 73% of children that are in foster homes today are on no less than three psychotropic and other types of drugs, which is sickening. It's just so sick. My parents never would have stood for that. Just to go on and start to kind of paint a bit of a picture about my mother, and then kind of get into some really kind of really just to try to paint the picture correctly here and accurately. My mother, again, I often kind of say my mother, you know, had the love and patience exceeding Gandhi. And I can definitely say that because Gandhi never dealt with, you know, the kids and some of the issues and things that my mom did. My mother, again, was a very, very simple farm girl. She, you know, grew up in Kansas and the plains of Nebraska, working, you know, on her father's farm. And again, very, very simple, nurturing, kind upbringing. And in fact, for years and years and years, we would go back and help harvest in the spring and summer. And I spent, you know, countless days and months, you know, working on the farm and having that experience. And I just tell you, it was one of the richest, heartening experiences I've ever had in my life, which was working hard on a farm, sweating, and again, you know, working with all the livestock and all the crops, and, you know, having wheelie contests, you know, with John Deere tractors and stuff. It was crazy. My cousins were just crazy. But we had the greatest time, and it was remarkable. Talk about some of the best food you could ever imagine. The carrots that my aunt would grow on the farm, I mean, apples are not as sweet as these carrots. They're just, I mean, that's one of the things I certainly remember fondly is all of the vegetables and all that. It's just remarkable. So, you know, again, my mother, she grew up in a fairly large family, working on the farm. Her brother went on to have a very large family. I think Uncle Gene ended up, I think, on his farm. He had, I think, 13 or 14 kids. And I think it was 14, ultimately. 14 kids. And, oh, my God, talk about a crazy scene that was. But that was, you know, part of my upbringing and the sensibility far aside from our life in the city, in the big metro where my parents would end up ultimately being here at the Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, in the city of Denver. But again, Mom, she is a simple woman. You know, she wasn't college educated. You know, she did graduate high school. You know, she wasn't a proud woman. She wasn't a glamour queen, but she had the, and I just see it is really ultimately the finest virtues ever displayed or awarded humanity, which is, you know, this unyielding, undying love, and care and empathy and compassion, but also knowledge and wisdom, hard work. She was the hardest working woman I've ever known. I mean, and I'll kind of tell you how hard she worked, but she was tireless. And she was, of course, the glue that held us all together. She was a force to just reckon with, I'll tell you. And just to explain, when my folks, you know, did move to Denver, they made a decision to become foster parents. My mother and father had one son, my older brother. I'm number two son. As Charlie Chan would say, number two son. I am number two son. Basically, I had seven kids in my family. All of us ultimately were adopted, all of us, except for my older brother. My mother couldn't have any more kids, and she just loved children. I mean, she'd adored them. And she was amazing. And I'll just tell you, over the years, just to give you an overview, over the course of 25 years, my parents took care of, on top of their own children, they took care of over 75 children over 25 years. So you do the math on that. At any given time in our household, under one roof, there were a minimum of probably 11, 13, 14 kids at any given time. And the thing was, is through the process, through, again, really the definition of leadership, the definition of a true role model, all of us saw her power, the power that she, the power of love and care and concern and the understanding of how to take care of ourselves. If a baby's crying, you know what? If at the age of 4 years old, let's say, at 4 years old, my mother taught us, you know, if one of the babies were crying, you go and comfort the baby. You know, you might have a 2 month or a 3 month old, you know, infant, and the 4 year old would go over and know how to comfort the baby. You know, once you got older than that, again, you're now, you know, the older kids, they had more responsibilities, much like on a farm, you know, by the time, you know, on a farm, by the time you're 10 years old, you're driving tractors, you know, a century ago, you know, by the time you were 16, you know, you were in charge of a whole family. In fact, by the time you're 18, you had your own family of your own, and you were, you know, again, going back to our, you know, covered wagon days, it's just remarkable how powerful and able our forefathers were in taking care of each other and teaching us, much like the American Native Indians, you know, teaching us by example how to take care of others, and through the process, again, galvanizing, you know, life skills, in which there no doctorate, you know, no college degree would ever in a billion years ever teach you those simple building blocks. But it goes far, it's much further than that, and it'll just, you know, again, you know, the duties that my mother squarely put on her shoulders, taking care of an army of, you know, young children. It was just insane. And I can't even, looking back, I can't even comprehend how they possibly did this, you know. Of course, there was obviously a certain budget, a certain income. My mother, you know, again, somehow managed to make ends meet with what we had, and nobody ever went hungry. In fact, just, I mean, if you ever, you know, see the gravy train on MASH or other, you know, a soup line or whatever, I mean, every day, you know, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, she's, you know, I mean, she, her cooking was to die for, and we, you know, we can, it was in bulk. I mean, it was like a, it was a soup kitchen, you know. She's feeding, you know, a dozen or more mouths every single meal, just to keep up with that. It's just, again, you know, these days, you know, people gripe, oh, you know, I'm holding down a job and I'm, you know, I'm feeding a couple kids and this and that. Well, try feeding a dozen kids, you know. And the thing is, Sally, these weren't just normal kids. Many, many, many of them had all types of issues. All types, I mean, you can imagine, all types of physical and emotional abuse. Many of these kids have been beaten, abused in ungodly manners, children that had all types of health issues, from Down syndrome, jaundice, epilepsy, heart problems, kidney, liver, everything you could imagine. And my mother, again, you know, we sat there and, you know, we would watch, you know, Marcus Welby, MD, and, you know, all these great doctor shows, you know, she loved them. And she, you know, decades, you know, virtually a lifetime before the internet, you know, where it's like, oh, well, what's your ailment? Well, let's just ask Mike Adams and, you know, Natural News what, you know, what we could use as a, you know, to help cure this, you know. She had to deal with emergencies in our house at any given time, you know. I mean, that's just, you know, of course, that's above all of us, you know, kids going out and getting broken bones or, you know, of course, we were maniacs when we were kids, you know, riding skateboards and bikes, you know. We would, in fact, you know, we had trash can jumping contests, you know, regularly on our bikes, you know, where we'd build these ramps and jet, you know, just barrel down the streets, you know, these hills as fast as we could to hit the end of these ramps to fly over. I think our record was close to a dozen. I think my buddy Mike, it was the neighborhood record, 10 trash cans on a Stingray bike. You know, he cleared 10 trash cans without killing himself. Well, I got to tell you, many of the kids in our neighborhood weren't that fortunate, including myself. You can't even imagine the scrapes and bloodied faces and elbows and knees. And, oh, my God, we were so, – and ultimately, many of the kids in our neighborhoods would go to the Jones house, and Mom would fix them up, you know. She would, you know, clean them up and, you know, again, just for anyone to, at the drop of the hat, have, you know, my younger brother was an epileptic. And all of us were taught what to do if you know, one of the kids had a seizure. We were taught what to do, symptoms to look for this and that, and you know, all of these types of issues. And that just went along. That was just part of the program. That was just part of it. That was just part of the deal. Was those types of life-threatening. Circumstance, you know, it was just unbelievable. You know, they would pack us all up in the station wagon. We'd go up in the mountains, and we'd go here, we'd go there, we'd do road trips, and we'd go visit the, you know, family, and of course, through the process, you know, we went to a lot of funerals throughout my entire childhood upbringing. You know, that was one of the things I do remember. We went to a lot of funerals, and that was, you know, again, life and death. We saw it all, you know, sitting there with my father and understanding the horrors, the carnage of war and what that really meant, you know, coming all the way through and understanding conversely the joys and the beauty and the love and respect, the dignity and all of the very finest that makes our species worthy of survival. You know, and again, I say this often, that if our species is ever judged by an alien race or by any benevolent, merciful God, I do believe even, you know, understanding the horrors of what's going on in our own government, you know, the three branches of government right now, the horrors of understanding about British Petroleum and Monsanto and you know, again, this the insanity of child slave rings that our government runs, you know, and all of these horrors. Again, conversely, at the very same time, I carry with me every single day is the absolute, genuine, full understanding of the meaning of what makes us worthy as a species. And again, if any god or alien species is to judge us, I hope that they do it fairly, and they, again, understand that, in fact, we are worthy. And it is because of these types of qualities that again, ultimately, I do believe, and we are at the turning point. You know this as an activist yourself, as a humanitarian, that we, our species right now, humanity is at a crossroads. This is a fork in the road, and you know, I just got to say that it is our choice. And I personally believe that as things ratchet up and get worse and worse, it will ultimately bring us together and help us understand what we do have to fight for, what is worthy of all of the struggle and all of the bloodshed of generations. You know, what does it come down to? It comes down to some very simple things: care, understanding. I mean, Sally, example would be yourself. You know, you are a role model. You are an absolute leader. You are one of the finest patriots that I know. And believe me, I know patriots that are there in Arlington Cemetery. I know I have worked with, again, the very definition of patriots. So, you know, again, these are the virtues that, again, ultimately I wanted to kind of flesh out through this story. So, again, this isn't just a story about, you know, how cool or great my parents were. No, they were great. They were great. They are great. And this is why, through all of these, you know, these adversities, all these challenges, as a parent, you know, my God, I was an academic for over a decade, and I taught at two different colleges, and I teach my students, the most important job you'll ever have in your life is to be a good parent, to be a mindful and an actively involved parent that is involved with their children's life every single day. That is the most important thing in the world. And if you look at any problem virtually in our society, it comes right down to the parents. What did they teach? You know, did we teach our children a rape society where it's okay to turn a blind eye if, oh, you guys get drunk and rape this girl? No, that's not okay. And it's our duty as parents to make damn sure what kind of society that we'll allow. And again, it comes down to very simple principles. And again, just, you know, yeah, just a simple understanding of what's right and wrong. Again, my mom was not a complicated woman whatsoever. She is a very simple woman. But again, the virtues that she taught us, kindness, compassion, how to take care of each other and ourselves, and to become better people through the process. Again, the examples I could tell you of miracles that I've seen, I will never forget. There are so many children. I could go on for hours, but I'm looking at the time, and I need to wrap up here pretty soon. But the thing is, the ability to take a child that has been abused, that doesn't even talk. You know, here's a 3-year-old that won't even look you in the eye, and all of a sudden they are immersed in this wonderful playland of children laughing and drawing and listening to music and playing and creating and building and imagining this and that. You know, even a 3-year-old or a 2-year-old within, and I'll tell you what, there was one example, and I'll just tell you now, a young Indian boy by the name of, oh, he was so wonderful. His name was Adrian Tucro. And I'll never forget this kid. He, again, I don't exactly remember his story, but he was abused, and he was basically traumatized, you know. And within just 2 weeks of being in our house, all of a sudden, you could see this spark in his eyes. He started to, you know, look and see, and all of a sudden, and of course, all of us, we're right there encouraging him. Oh, hey, Adrian, you know, and we're, you know, in his crib and kind of playing with him. And, you know, some of us, we crawl up in the crib and lay with him and play, you know, and you know, be there. And again, in 2 weeks or less, all of a sudden you see this transformation. And those are some of the things that I'll never forget, that my mother taught us. She had that. Again, you know, just this magical ability, and she taught all of us to you know, that's how it was. I mean, that's what we taught. You know, you think any of us, you know, were racist? We were never. That the concept of that type of discrimination, that wasn't even conceivable. It was never, ever even imaginable or part of our conscious is to think. I mean, we had children of all colors. It didn't matter a damn bit. You know, we were all kids, pure and simple. Boys, girls, didn't matter. You know, it was just crazy, beautiful, really. I mean, just again, this extraordinary, place where, again, it was loud, it was crazy, chaotic. All the time, you know, but at night, you know, we'd all calm down and just, you know, we'd go to bed, and, you know, everyone had their night lights and, you know, their beds, and, you know, and we were all safe and very, very loved. There was more love under that one roof. I mean, there was more love under the Jones roof. I mean, if you could beam that across the planet, everyone would feel it. I mean, it would be a light that would be a million kelvins. It would be so bright. So again, that's kind of where I come from, you know, and what these two brought to all of us, not just myself, my sister. I had one sister, and then the rest of us were brothers, and we all got in our own trouble. And one of the most beautiful things, I'll never forget this, I was, again, not just a ruffian. I pushed it. You know, I don't even know what it was that my parents saw in me. I was adopted when I was just 3 months old. And here's a young, Native Indian child, you know, and I don't know if it was my just stunning handsomeness and, you know, my smile or bright eyes or what my parents saw in me, God bless them, but they adopted all of us, you know. And again, I pushed it. Everything I pushed. I pushed everything, you know. We had a saying, of course, question authority. As George Carlin once said, well, guess what? There's a point where we figure out that parents are authority. So, you know, I hate to say, I put my parents through hell, living hell. And as I look back, I can't even imagine my daughters putting me through that hell. And thank God they didn't. But I did. But you know what? I matured. And I did get to, you know, tell, basically, I grew up, and I you know, again, I very remorsefully had, a heart-to-heart with both my mother and father, and just, you know, again, was able to tell them how horrible I felt about putting them through hell, you know, bloodied faces, and, I mean, you know, all the horrors, but then also just being a bastard, you know, just being a, you know, of course I'm a Taurus, but, you know, far aside from that, you know, I was at some points not kind, you know, and that was not what they taught us. But I rose above it, and because of, you know, the trouble, and I know it's not like I got thrown into, you know, juvenile hall or anything that severe, close, you know, very close. I did some very questionable things, to say the least, things I am not proud of, and things I will not really even mention to my daughters. Some things I will, and I'll certainly own up to all of it. In fact, that's something they taught us. You own up to it. You know, you own up to your own crap. And we did. And we were punished, you know, and they put the fear of God in us, and that was something else. You know, we were disciplined, no ifs, ands, or buts, and I do believe that it did make us better, better humans, better people, better, you know, just better with that kind of understanding. But again,
you better say something in conclusion, my friend Joe Jones of airmail-greek.com.
Absolutely. Well, again, you know, I kind of paint this crazy, wonderful picture about this, you know, noisy family, you know, down the street with so many kids out, you know, it's like,